Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie.
What a nice man and what a great musician Richard Thompson is. Guitar player, singer, songwriter, co-founder of the legendary folk rock band Fairport Convention in England in the 60s. And he is still going strong. I mean, he lives in the US now and he mostly plays solo shows, solo concerts, as he did on the 1st of July at the Kleiner Saal in our recital hall in the Elbphilharmonie. Of course, his own songs, and it was brilliant. I mean, to see how this man plays all this intricate stuff on the guitar and sings in parallel. I mean, strumming chords and singing is already something in itself, but his way of treating the instrument is quite unique and really spellbinding, I find. His songs and the melodies are not the easiest ones, so there's an artistry at work that is really very impressive, and people were impressed. I mean, they were really celebrating this great, great musician. Before, just, you know, an hour before he went on stage, he took the time to give me an interview for our podcast series, Elbphilharmonie Talk. And I'm Tom, and I was really happy and delighted to have Richard Thompson with me, and I hope you enjoy our conversation. Thank you. Richard Thompson, it's such an honor and such a joy to have you here.
Thank you so much. It's great to be here.
I'm really happy. You know, this dressing room ordinarily would have been occupied by Blixar Bargeld tonight. Have you heard this name?
I've heard the name, yes.
So he's the singer of Einstürzende Neubauten.
Okay.
Which is like the best known new wave punk industrial band of Germany ever to come out. But they couldn't play tonight because I think three of them got COVID. So the show was cancelled just last minute.
Yeah, I'm sorry to hear it.
This entire floor, including the Grand Hall, is empty tonight.
Yeah.
And we have just you perform in the recital hall. And
well, you know, I had to cancel last week. I had to cancel Glastonbury.
Oh.
Because I had mild COVID, but it threw my voice. Couldn't
it? Was affected.
Sing a note, yeah.
And it has fully recovered and you feel...
I hope so. We'll see. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed.
We'll see how it goes tonight.
So you couldn't play Glastonbury. And I was wondering, how many shows did you play now on this European leg of this is?
We're just doing five shows on this leg. We just did a boat down the Rhine, which was quite fun. And next month we have a boat down the Danube, which will be fun too. So bits and pieces. We did a couple of shows in Spain a few weeks ago. So bits and pieces and some shows in the UK. So it's mostly a European summer. Then I have to run back for my guitar camp. I have a guitar camp in America.
Oh, wow.
So I have to go back to Woodstock in America.
The legendary Woodstock.
The legendary Woodstock, where I'm actually living right now. So.
Are you living? We have your wonderful book, B-Swing, on the table, and I just managed to get it right in time, and I was immersing myself in reading your... And it just captures 8 years of your life between 1967 and 1975, and it ends quite sadly and abruptly. Mm-hmm. And it yearns for some kind of continuity, in my understanding at least. So I wonder, are you planning to write more about what came after 75?
You know, what came immediately after, I didn't think was that interesting. Maybe I have to jump a few years to get to the next interesting bit. You know, I have to get to early 80s or something. But perhaps, or I might do it more episodically, more as kind of shorter chapters that are not necessarily connected, but just bits and pieces that dip into, you know, my life as a musician here and there. So that might be a better approach for the next bit.
Yeah.
The nice thing about doing this book was, you know, when you're young, when you're 18 years old, everything's very new. So everything you experience is like, wow, you know, that's fantastic, this is fantastic.
And it was a fantastic time.
But on top of that, you know, being in London, where it was the real center of music and fashion and all that stuff, you know, and psychedelia and heaven knows what. So that was all great. But then after you've played perhaps the same venue 15 times, you know, it's harder to write about it. You know, what's new this time? Well, maybe nothing. So I might have to be more picky for the next book, and it might have to cover a longer period of years.
Yeah, but still, I wonder, I mean, these the events in here go back until 55 years from now, so mm-hmm. did you keep, like, journaling, or...?
Oh, I wish I had. Oh.
You haven't? Yeah.
Sadly. In some cases, the hardest thing with the book was actually achieving some kind of chronology, because, I couldn't remember... Other band members, I asked, you know, did you remember this date? They said, oh, I can't remember that. No, sorry. So I had to really piece together what happened when. There was nothing really complete. You know, agents, in order to avoid paying tax, would burn their records and stuff. The paper trail stops. You know?
So the track record was kind of failing.
I hope it's accurate at this point, but that was the hardest thing, really.
So you worked this book together with Scott Timberg, who is an LA cultural writer who is not alive anymore, unfortunately. How did you proceed? I mean, would you just tell him everything and he would just bring it into a form? Or did you actually really write and work and say, look at this, does it make sense or not?
Yes. This was Scott's idea. He said, you must write about this time period. Mm-hmm. So I said, fine. So we started doing a series of interviews. And then Scott would write it up and I'd say, there's something missing, which is actually... a voice, I'm not hearing my own voice in the process. So I said, well, I'll go away and write it, and then you come in and edit it at the end.
Okay.
But sadly, Scott passed away before that could happen. So I give him full credit for beginning the project.
For instigating the idea of doing it.
But it never quite got completed the way it was supposed to.
Oh, very sad. Mm. Yeah. The subtitle somehow maybe even refers to what you're telling me right now. I mean, losing my way and finding my voice. If you read these memoirs of this period, it feels like you have absolutely also found your way in, playing guitar all the time and really composing and honing your skill and compiling all these old songs from Scotland and England and Ireland and building this huge repertoire of yours and this consciousness of the importance of the English song history. So I was wondering, why this subtitle? What kind of way did you lose in order to find your voice?
I will just say that subtitles are not really my domain. They come from the publishers.
Okay.
There's a different subtitle in the UK to the US.
Oh, which goes hard?
I can't remember. It mentions Fairport, whereas in America, Fairport doesn't mean very much, so they left that out. But the same thing, losing my way, finding my voice, I can see how that works, and it's kind of catchy.
It's catchy, but it's maybe not so utterly true, to be honest.
I mean, I would never say that about myself. I had a whole different subtitle, which I've actually forgotten now, which I thought was kind of snappier and a bit more cynical.
More your...
Yes.
Your energy.
Publishers kind of do what they do, and there's no argument. So, I'm happy that they, with their expertise...
Yeah, and they did a very nice job on the cover, I find. It looks really beautiful and intriguing. And, of course, I mean, finding my voice, the only thing I could refer to would be that, I mean... Given the astute singer you have become afterwards, maybe even after
well, that's true. Yeah.
That's true.
Yeah, so, I have developed as a singer. That's absolutely true.
Yeah, yeah.
So, I lose my way on a daily basis. Every single day, I lose my way completely.
Which is nice.
I have a bad sense of direction.
Okay. But, I mean, you are writing about roadies who have even a worse sense of direction than you have.
Right, yeah.
Driving you all around, what was it in Boston or where you worked? Never ending up in your hotel and stuff.
It's a tough town to navigate, Boston.
True. I've been there myself.
Yeah.
But as funny as those anecdotes are, I find it really a very good and very thoughtful and thorough book on this period of English music. Mm. And... here in Germany, even, I think, of course, Fairport Convention is a household name for many people of that generation. Mm. But I think it was more, the bigger halls were always like Jethro Tull or your generational, like Dave Pegg or so, mm-hmm. play in both bands. And it's like a missing piece, That's explaining true. A lot.
I felt was always to say that, folk rock, British folk rock was always a cult. In a sense that it never really achieved what we wanted it to achieve in terms of popularity. We really thought, taking our own culture and kind of feeding it back to the audience in a modern guise, in the guise of a rock band, would give people a real access to their own culture. But they never quite grasped it. They never quite got hold of it in that way.
Mm-hmm.
And they always preferred, the Rolling Stones version of culture or the Muddy Waters version of culture.
The direct import from the US.
Yeah, pretty much. Or the UK version of the US.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, yeah.
the British invasion. Mm. What I found really ironic almost is you are quite opinionated about American music invading Great Britain at that time. But still, I mean, you live in the US now. Mm-hmm. So what made you change your mind so drastically that you would even leave your home country for the bad America?
Mostly work.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, actually, I'm trying to think when it happened, but probably the early 80s. But prior to that, I hadn't been to America for 10 years. So Fairport went in 1970. Then I left the band. I never went back for 10 years. And in 1980, 81, we had an album out called Shoot Out the Lights, which was kind of a college hit. So it was a hit on college radio, public radio.
And you realigned with Joe Boyd at that time, with your manager and Spiritus Rector and stuff.
Yeah, and so so suddenly I found that there was an audience in America. It was actually younger than me. It was like 10 years younger than I was. And so off the back of that, I had a whole touring career, which I'm still involved in, really. And it's been slower to build the audience actually in the UK. Now I can fill halls in the UK, but it took a long time. I was much more accepted in America first, more as a singer-songwriter rather than for anything to do with British tradition or anything like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And now the Brits, what do they cherish most? Just as that you're such an eminent figure in the history, or is it still the Britishness in your songwriting, or what is it?
I suppose a combination of those things. I think the Britishness they like, as they like the Britishness of Ray Davis or something. I think they just like the fact that as a songwriter, you appear to be telling people's life stories for them. Mm-hmm. You're speaking for them. Somehow that they identify with you, as they identify with Kate Bush or they identify with whoever. You know, the audience finds you sometimes rather than you find the audience.
This is all the way that you preferred it to be, rather than, you know, bending and trying to please audiences.
I think it's more permanent. I think if people find you that way, then they kind of stay with you.
And you remain consistent in your personality in a way.
I try to. I do what I do, and I'm glad people like it, but I'm kind of involved in what I do and where that leads me. Mm-hmm. If the audience stays with me, I think that's a good thing. You know, sometimes I make an album and people say, well, you know, Not as good as the last one, or not as good as...
That's always the case.
Hasn't done a good record for 10 years. I think, well, you know, okay, whatever. But I sort of have to do what I do. And hopefully now and then, you know, things get picked up by people. Sometimes it's just individual songs. People like a certain song, or people like a whole album. That's great, you know. But, you know, enough that people remain with you.
Mm-hmm. To what extent... I mean, first question, when did you actually move to the US?
I never felt I really moved. I've been so backwards and forwards.
You haven't got an American passport, or do you have an American passport?
I'm still a UK citizen. You know, I have an American green card, that kind of stuff. So I suppose 82.
After the breakup of your marriage.
I married an American woman, so it was logical to spend more time in California at that time. But, you know, we always went backwards and forwards, you know, 3-4 times a year. And I've done that ever since. So I've never felt away from Europe. And I love the connection with Europe. And more I actually crave European culture. As America gets stranger and weirder and darker, I'm much happier here.
Even though maybe also Great Britain has had better days than...
in spite of that, yeah.
In spite of it, still, it's better.
In spite of Boris,
I wonder, I mean, let's still say roughly 40 years of America. Did this somehow rub on your songwriting?
You know, some people that I know, friends of mine, within a year of moving to America, you know, they have an American accent, you know, they're watching American football, they've just taken on the whole package and they just love it. I can't do that. I just see as something, you know, I don't ever want to lose my Britishness, you know.
And you still sound wonderfully British to me. So.
Yeah, I think I do, yeah. And online you can read your British newspapers and you can get your cricket and your football and everything. Now, I can sit in America and watch, the Premier League cheaper than I can in the UK.
I see.
So, you know, it's very easy these days, whatever your culture is, to stay true to it and to stay in contact with it.
But at the same time, you are living on a day-to-day basis with the American realities, with the smells, with everything, you know, with the sound of the music, of course, that you're going to be exposed there, more or less. And I wonder, did this really influence maybe in the second run more of your songwriting? Or would you still say, well, it doesn't matter at all where I live, my songs are?
You know, I think what I tend to do is create a parallel. If I hear a great country song or something, and I say, well, that's really great. how would I be influenced by that? I'd create a kind of a parallel song with perhaps the same emotion, but with a more of a European root to it, you know? Mm-hmm. And also forget how close something like country music is to European roots. I mean, you know, it's the Appalachian Mountains, all those immigrants from Scotland, Ireland, England,
Europe,
to taking traditional songs that are already hundreds of years old to the Appalachian Mountains, and then that becomes old-timey music, then old-timey becomes country music.
Plus the fiddle tradition, of course.
You know, and country tunes are so Scottish. I mean, there's absolutely pentatonic tunes. So it's a close thing. So for me to just write kind of like parallel English country songs, it's very easy, you know. So if I'm influenced by Hank Williams, who I am, I think, it comes out in a different way.
Do you play pedal steel guitar at times?
I said, no, I always thought that was culturally a step too far. It's like kind of getting away from my culture. No, it sort of fascinates me. And adopt some of those licks for the guitar, some of those pedal steel things.
But just using the bottleneck instead?
And just using fingers, bending strings, you know, and stuff.
Yeah.
So I sort of had a semi-career as a session musician, you know, but playing that kind of stuff in the UK.
Now, tonight you are going to perform songs to the acoustic guitar with metal strings, right? Western strings.
Yeah.
Leaving the electric guitar behind was just out of which reason? Because, I mean, you're...
I don't find it... If I'm playing solo, I don't find electric guitar works. You know, it has a much narrower sonic range. Acoustic guitar, you've got a fairly broad spectrum, a tonal spectrum. Electric guitar always sounds like there's not enough top and not enough bottom end on the music. So I tend not to do that. I haven't done it for years and years and years. But I find once the audience's ears get adjusted, they don't miss it. And I don't miss it.
Yes, of course, there's also another intimacy probably to,
yeah,
you know, to the busker who's just singing his songs so proficiently.
I think on an acoustic show, intimacy is such a big thing. Sometimes I think it's like going to church or something. You create a stillness, a quietness, and you can really draw people into you, you know. You feel the audience get closer and closer. It's a lovely thing.
How do you like the hall?
Beautiful. Really beautiful. Sounds great. Sounds really good.
It's kind of embracing the audience, I find, when you stand on stage. You know, it's so wide, and then it's getting very narrow in the back, even though it's the same rectangular space, and people are very close.
Yeah.
So I'm curious to see how you will like it.
I'll let you know after it's
yes,
over.
Please do so. How many of these songs could you play right away out of your head if I would wake you up like it's 8
well,
o'clock in the morning?
Maybe only 100.
Only 100?
Yeah. 500? Yeah, I can't keep all of them in my head anymore. I forget whole songs, and I have to go back and relearn them sometimes.
And how about the motoric memory of the fingers? Do they then at some point instinctively remember and know where to go?
Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. Which is a problem. Sometimes they do request shows.
Okay.
Where people put requests in a bucket.
Right before the show starts.
And the rule is I have to play whatever comes out.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah. So that's a real challenge. I know this is my song, you know, thank you, but I can't remember the words or the music.
Does the audience at times help you out just by singing it to you and then you kind of scrambly remember bits and pieces?
Sometimes the audience can be quite sadistic and just out to almost like trip me up, you know, to as if I'm the teacher of the class and they're going to come up with some smart asked idea, you know.
And you have to surrender say,
I. Very occasionally I have to surrender, but it doesn't happen too often.
That's good. That's good. Maybe also because maybe most of the audience doesn't remember so well the 400 other songs.
Yeah. Which exactly.
Also,
yeah.
Which also might be a reason.
That helps.
Yeah.
That helps.
What I found utterly interesting, also out of personal interest, is of course your spiritual quest that you are writing about, albeit rather briefly, you know, the Sufism thing. And I wonder how close are you still to this world?
Still close, yeah. I connect to the practices in North Africa, in Morocco, Algeria.
Yeah.
And I've done that now for 40 years plus, yeah.
So you are also into the music of this culture?
Yeah,
The Gnawa thing, the Dervish...
I can't say that I've learnt it well enough to embrace it, but to me, very interesting, what they consider the classical music of North Africa, which is Andalus, comes from Andalusian Spain, southern Spain, at the time of the Moors, the Moors were there for 500-600 years. Mm-hmm. It's a science of music, like Indian rugs are a science of music. and it has rules and it has modes. You know, to me, that's very interesting. I would theorize that that had an influence on the rest of Europe as well at the same time, that filtered up through the troubadours and the trouvères and the Meistersinger. So it kind of it's crept its way up through Europe and had an influence. So to me, it's an interesting study to figure that stuff out.
And that would even include the oud, the Arabic lute.
Yeah, music is, again, very beautiful and has its own rules. And but it's very music. It's a bit like almost equate it with the cello. It's kind of in the same range, since in that baritone range, and it seems to have the same effect on the heart. You know, that just has that very
humane,
moving quality.
Yeah, and no frets. And do you play it?
I've tried, but it's a whole tradition. And I would be cheating myself if I didn't take it up wholeheartedly and embrace it and study it absolutely full-time, which I haven't done yet.
Are there any aspirations as to learn some instruments in this huge family of your instrument that still come to mind? I mean, you play mandolin, you play
guitar. I'd like to learn the cello.
Cello?
Yeah. Yeah.
Which would involve the whole bowing stuff.
Yeah. Did you
ever try?
Yeah, I'm not there, but as a guitarist, maybe you have some advantages with the left hand, some disadvantages with the left hand.
Yeah, because it's fifth and not fourth. Of course, and the fingering, of course, is different.
Yeah. Fifth instead of fourth, but that's okay. Again, muscle memory with the cello, where you have to know where you're going.
Do you take lessons?
I would if I was going to be serious, yeah.
But you haven't yet.
No. There's also the Baroque cello, which has frets, so I could cheat.
The viola da gamba. Because that would nicely blend into your deep interest into earlier music. I saw your show on video, of course. I saw this 1,000 years of, what was it, popular music or song? And going back to this area. At some point, see you sitting on stage playing viola da gamba would be...
That would be fun, yeah.
That would be fun, wouldn't it? So, Richard, I thank you very much for
taking
some of your time. And
just
looking
pleasure.
Forward
to, absolute pleasure. Thank
to
you.
Hearing you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Elbphilharmonie Talk, der Gesprächspodcast der Elbphilharmonie. Dieser Podcast wird vermarktet durch die Podcastbude.